Hello, folks. Thank you for coming. We are delighted to have you here. This evening is a joint presentation of the Project on Justice in Times of Transition, which is now a strategic ally of the Institute for Global Leadership, and we are delighted that this is taking place. Iran. It's as complicated an issue as I've encountered in the 25 years of doing programming here at our university. My name is Sherman. I direct the Institute for Global Leadership. We had the opportunity with our new initiative for Middle East Peace to send a delegation of Fletcher and Tufts undergraduates to Qom, to the university, to dialogue with the Ayatollahs and students there, and then the School of International Relations in Tehran. This was about 4 years, 2004, I guess. And our students wanted to go back again this year, but we prevailed in the sense that we were very worried about whom they might compromise, given what we are now understanding is the nature of political discourse or the lack of it in the aftermath of this election on the campuses and elsewhere in Iranian society. But it is clearly the proliferation issue and its attendant threats and the intensity of this debate, which is just ratcheted up in the last few days, looking at the disclosures of what is apparently 20 miles away from where our students dialogue with the students. We've known Jim Walsh for many years and been engaged in proliferation issues with Graham Allison and others, and so we've fused interests at the Institute between our Middle East concerns and our Iranian concerns, and we cast about for someone to think with us about this, and there could be no one better than Ambassador Lures. He has, as you're well aware, an extraordinary distinguished foreign service background, diplomatic background, and indeed his ambassadorships have ranged from Venezuela to Czechoslovakia. He has been involved deeply at the highest levels of Latin America and Europe. But we've asked him to come and out of the panoply of his past to think with us about what he's doing now in the vitality of his work with Ambassador Pickering and with Jim Walsh, to think with us about how it's possible to resonate the course that he's teaching at Fletcher for us and our undergraduates. How do you talk with the enemy? How do you engage diplomatically with this remarkably thorny issue? So that's the nature of this evening. Ambassador Lures, it's a tremendous honor to have you here and to have your wife, Wendy, deeply involved with us and the Institute's board in our work. And I never, ever want to lose the occasion to think about the incredible work that the project does all over the world. But now we're able also to benefit from your presence. And we were honored to award him the Dr. Jean Mayer Award at dinner. It goes to people of stature that we believe have the ethics and the human imperative necessary to honor Jean Mayer. And Bill Lures is a very distinguished now recipient of that. We're very pleased that you accepted this award and that you have accepted to speak with us this evening. I've asked Bill to speak for about 30 to 40 minutes and then to engage you in question and answer. Ambassador Lures.
Thank you, Sherm. I'm so pleased to be back on a campus after all these years when I haven't been able to teach, and Tufts will be my first experience again teaching, and I'm honored, Sherm, that you of all people have been the one to engage me in this process. I had my first class today, and I had great fun with some of the students who are here today. I wanted you to know that what happened last week in U.S.-Iranian relations was so unsettling and so surprising that I've decided to speak about a much easier issue tonight, how to reach a settlement between the Arabs and Israelis. I have a solution, and if you'd rather hear me present the absolute final conclusion, I'll do that. Otherwise, I'll sort of struggle through a discussion of Iran, which I'm not sure is going to be satisfying for anyone. Which would you like, my solution or my confusion? Anyway, I Let's talk first about last week and then about my involvement with Iran and then about what I think about the nature of U.S.-Iranian relations and how they have to be dealt with. First, the Jim Walsh, Tom Pickering, Frank Wisner and I had dinner with the president of Iran last Thursday night. There were about, I guess, 30 academics that he's invited. I've been to this event every year for 5 years, ever since he's been president. And it was a stunning evening because he was so nice. You know, the fact that I could ever say that about this horror, I don't, you know. But he was polite. He kept saying, thank you for your question. You're so kind. You know, he never tangled with any of us. And it was I was sort of quite surprised about it. And I wrote, as I often do at the State Department and the Senate and others, about what I'm thinking with regard to these contacts that we've had over these years. And I said, there's something going on. Well, the next morning, it's announced that this facility has been identified and talked about, revealed by the Iranians to the IAEA on the basis, with the understanding, I guess, that we knew about it and have known about it and tracking it for somewhere between 18 months and 2 years. Now, there's at least one point of view that suggests that Ahmadinejad really didn't know a lot about this. I'm not sure I believe that, but that's at least one proposition, that he was surprised himself, either about the level of knowledge we had on it, or about the nature of the operation itself. This strikes me as being unrealistic, but given what I know and don't know about Iran, it's not surprising. But the fact is, everything changed that day in many ways from the standpoint of the U.S. government. You can't know what's happening inside the Iranian government, how they're dealing with this new set of information, how they will respond with regard to the meeting that are being held tomorrow of the P5 plus one with Iran to discuss these very issues. And we don't know whether when we actually get, if there are inspectors who get close to it, they will be able to have a better understanding than we have now about what is the purpose or what is the ostensible purpose of this facility, which, to say the least, seems suspicious because it's on a military base. It's smaller than the Natanz facility that they have for enrichment. And it is thrown into kelter mostly by the way President Obama reacted to it. And this is what is both surprising and disturbing. When he stood on that platform the next day with Gordon Brown and Sarkozy, the three of them, grim, threatening, solidly behind the basic statement that they cannot do this. They must do the following 10 things. We will not allow them to continue this process. It was echoes of the last 8 years that I was surprised to hear from our president, given the fact that when he came to office, I was convinced that he brought a new perspective that would allow us to stand back a bit from the nuclear issue and think about Iran as a country in the middle of the most turbulent part of the world, without which I don't think we can find real stability. If we don't have Iran as a player with other nations. So with that as a background, let me go back to where I began. I'm not a Farsi speaker. I'm not an Iranian specialist. my entire career was spent in the Foreign Service, was spent in the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe and in Latin America. So I don't pretend to be an authority on Iran. But while I was head of United Nations Association, we began to work with the Iranians on something called the Dialogue of Civilizations, which was Khatami's discussion that he held with Kofi Annan to say, look, let's take Sam Huntington's idea of a clash of civilizations, turn it on its head, and have this global effort to find out can Islam, could the countries under Islam and the West, actually be able to find a way to talk across these cultural divides. And we worked as the staff for that, and as a result of that work, in the middle of November of 2001, only a month and a half after 9/11, the then president of Iran, Khatami, came to the UN and announced this. And the most important thing that he said publicly and forcefully in the General Assembly was that Osama bin Laden does not represent Islam. And mind you, he is a renegade as far as we're concerned. That appeared on the 7th page at the bottom of the page in the New York Times. What did appear was all of our work in Afghanistan and our getting close to Kabul and the work we'd done to move troops into Afghanistan. And clearly that statement by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, disassociating himself and other Muslims from Osama, was gold. But it passed in the night. But it is part of the metaphor of how we keep misunderstanding each other and keep having different agendas. Then we began a process of talking to a group of Iranians. We would meet in a European capital, and we would meet every two or three times a year. I had probably 40 or 50 Americans coming through this process of spending these 3 days with us talking to Iranians about the big issues. And these were all very bright, extremely intelligent, rather, Iranians who spoke English, because none of us spoke Farsi. And the discussions ranged across the whole range, across the whole extent of our relationships. As a result of that period, and by the way, I had one senator, senior senator, spend 2 to 3 days sitting with us thinking about these issues, one member of Congress, some influential people from both the currently in the government and then not. So we touched a lot of people, and we weren't the only ones doing this. Ours was unique because we met regularly and we did it for over these many years. And then we began meeting with the foreign minister. We've had these meetings with the now president. I met Khatami a couple of times. So we had both the official level from Iranian side and the unofficial level, and we did spend a great deal of time briefing many agencies of the U.S. government. We were very close to the State Department. We regularly briefed the National Security Council under Bush and also under President Obama. So we found ourselves in a role which was focused almost entirely on trying to help the U.S. and Iran find a way to talk officially together. We didn't see ourselves as intermediaries, but we found ourselves in that position occasionally. Neither side wanted us to be intermediaries, and we didn't want it. But the process was something that allowed us, finally, this team of six or seven Iranians and the core of our team, to write a joint paper, which was a paper that said, look, this is the history of this relationship. We as Iranians and Americans have sat together all these years, and we think this is the nature of the problem and the sets of steps we need to take to get out of this hole we're in. It was a paper that was finally translated into Farsi. We're told that it was read by very senior officials, including the Supreme Leader. We had many senior officials in the United States read it. In fact, we had a meeting at the State Department in which Tom and Frank and others of us sat opposite the table with the Undersecretary for Political Affairs and most of the assistant secretaries in the State Department. And we went through the paper, explaining to them what we thought we'd learned about U.S.-Iranian relations. And we kept ourselves to this for all those years. Even after Ahmadinejad began to cut off the contacts we had, we still found ways to meet with some Iranians and Iranian officials. And finally, we made one proposal on the nuclear arrangement, which we published later. And I wrote it as a memorandum to the president from us. We wrote it together. Jim was a key drafter, so was Tom. And it was a tough memorandum. It said, now you've got the Iranians where you want them. Sort of, now you can drive home the deal, and this is how you do it. I was told rather sadly by one of the senior officials who came to me and said, Bill, I can't sell this. Clearly Cheney had scuttled the whole idea, and any plan under the Bush administration to negotiate with Iran, if they weren't going to stop enrichment, was going nowhere. So with that, I told my contacts in the government that Tom and Jim and I were going to go public with our proposal, which we did in an article in the New York Review of Books in 2008, and then again this year in 2009, we wrote a second article. And these articles were basically trying to convey our sense of what needed to be, how we need to think about Iran if we're going to turn the corner on the current policies that the Bush administration was having. And since we couldn't affect the Bush administration, our hope was to open the discussion within the United States and within the Democratic Party establishment, assuming that a Democrat would win the presidency. So our effort was to come out of the closet and tell our story as well as we could tell it. And we do think that these two articles had some impact on changing the nature of the dialogue. Where are we? When President Obama came in, I was convinced that here is a president who instinctually knows what has to be done, that here is a man who will not be trapped by the bureaucracy, which was all focused on a single issue. Iran was the equivalent of the first big proliferator of nuclear weapons. So the case against Iran was the case against nuclear bombs not being built. We had tried through our articles, through other efforts, through constant working with the government to say, look, we have serious interests in Iran that are clouded by the nuclear issue, but this isn't the only issue. And indeed, it shouldn't be the driving issue of what we want to do with Iran. We couldn't imagine how the United States could disengage from Iraq and begin the process of turning it, you know, leaving behind a government heavily influenced by Iran without some understanding with Iran and maybe the other bordering countries about what the future of Iraq would look like. How would the neighbors relate to an Iraq without overriding U.S. forces there? Would they agree not to send arms in? Would they agree to restrain themselves from interfering in the internal affairs? Would they agree to large-scale economic development and assistance? Would they agree to open trade? And would they agree to supporting the territorial integrity of Iran, which was the most important proposition for Turkey, because Turkey, the last thing Turkey wants is for Kurdistan to break off, as all of you know. So Iran was critical to get that type of agreement even talked about. Secondly, in Afghanistan, as most of you know, It was the Iranians who enabled us to work with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan that then made it possible for us to enter Afghanistan and become as effective as we were in getting to Kabul and throwing the Taliban out at the time from running the country. The Iranians felt that they were working with us closely. Indeed, we had several meetings in Germany on the future of Afghanistan, at which the United States and Iran were sort of leaders. We met frequently with them. This was in late 2002. In late 2001, early 2002. And they thought that we were on a new track, that it wasn't that we were opposed to Iran, but we were cooperating on a mutually important subject. And those people who were working those talks, and one of them was the Iranian I knew, and Jim Dobbins, who was the American, I've talked to about this, and they personally were encouraged that finally we have a common purpose, we have a common cause, and out of that may grow a broader relationship where we can talk about some of the real problems. And then, lo and behold, on January 20th, 2002, only weeks after a meeting was held in Germany in which we and the Iranians sort of led the charge to help the recovery of Afghanistan, President Bush made his famous Axis of Evil talk, which shut down any hope on the part of the Iranians that they could deal with Iran, and more importantly, that they could deal with the United States, and more importantly, the United States had any interest in dealing with Iran, in cooperating in any way. And then, of course, came the entry into Iraq, and it scared. We were with the Iranians, our Iranian group in Europe at the time that we understand they made this offer in the spring of 2003 to open discussions again. Rejected out of hand, even some of the officials at the time claim they never remember receiving anything like this. So the ideological position of the Bush administration became a pillar of our policy in the Middle East, that we will not deal with Iran, we will not negotiate with them, we will begin to tell them that they should not have nuclear weapons under any circumstances, and we won't let them do it. Bush kept using these terms that we will not permit it, it's against our policy, and he got consistently, he was found himself able to threaten them, and he continued to say that no options are off the table with regard to our conviction that you should not have you should not have a nuclear program or nuclear weapons. And the Europeans came along with us in the early days, principally because they were afraid that if they didn't join us in the strong sanctions against Iran, that the United States, that the Bush administration would join Israel in a military attack against Iran. Now, that process of the Bush administration standing firm was driven basically by people like John Bolton and others who were running nuclear policy at the time. Iran was owned by the non-proliferators in the U.S. government. None of the people who knew Iran, who'd had a feeling about these broader regional issues, who felt that, who understood that without dealing with Iran as a country, you can't get to these individual issues such as nuclear. These people were cut out and eventually silenced themselves. It became no longer a debate, particularly in the last 2 years of the Bush administration. We hoped that the way President Obama spoke as a candidate, the messages he gave in that first 6 months, which were confirmed by various ways to us that he had indeed stretched out the hand to the Iranians, that he'd sent them a couple of messages. he sent this famous message on the Iranian New Year, which was a brilliant bit of drafting. His sensitivity to what had to be said was quite remarkable. And we thought he was on that track. This summer, we went to Washington and we met with a lot of people, and we sent a memorandum to senior people, Tom, Frank, and myself, and Stephen Heinz, who's head of Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who was a colleague of ours in this whole effort, and Jim Walsh. We all went. And we basically said, Mr. President, you're on the right track. The elections held that were held in Iran are, clearly a bump in the road that is serious. And the timing domestically is going to be important. But the fundamental issues are the following. Sanctions will not change Iran's behavior. It will not cease, it will not stop them from enriching uranium. Secondly, Iran has chosen this route for a variety of reasons, one of which may be nuclear weapons, one of which may be to get your attention and the world's attention. But you can't deal directly with the nuclear question without dealing with the broader issue. The only way to approach Iran today to get to the issues that are important are, first, that you, Mr. President, have to say to the leader of Iran in some form that you believe that the United States and Iran must have a strategic relationship to begin the discussion of some details and problems. Strategic relationship means something like China, in which Nixon and Kissinger went to arguably the most horrid leader of the 20th century, Mao Zedong, and said in 1973, look, we're going to open relationships with you, begin our discussions, and we'll list those areas where we disagree and list those areas where we agree, and we will pledge to each other that through discussions together, we will find ways to diminish the areas of difference and expand the areas in which we can work together. And in fact, Nixon never mentioned Taiwan in his discussion with Mao. They left those questions, those details to the diplomats who were traveling with them. They gave Mao the dignity of saying, you are a power, we're a power. Let's think about how we establish the type of relationship that will make these relations, that will make us able to solve problems. And we've got a lot of them. It worked. The same thing with Roosevelt with Stalin in 1933. Now, we argued, I think, persuasively, that unless you, Mr. President, decide that U.S. interests are overriding all other concerns we have with Iran, the U.S. interests in establishing relationship with Iran override everything else, and that only then will they be in a position to begin to talk about other things, Afghanistan, drugs, Hezbollah, Israel, and Iraq, and nuclear, will you be able to have a serious relationship that might bear fruit? And it will take a long time, a lot of patience. Now, we were told by several people that the president thinks the way you do. Other people didn't think the way we did, but the president did. And so what confuses me now is what happened last week. How did the president find himself in that uncharacteristic threatening posture that he found himself in with regard to this issue? I am absolutely persuaded that the United States cannot persuade Iran to stop its nuclear program. But I am persuaded that we can get to the point where we can persuade them to allow much closer inspections. What we need in Iran is inspections. We need to monitor everything they're doing and have people on the ground doing it. I know we could have gotten there 5 years ago and 4 years ago had the Bush administration tried it. But here we are. And I guess the bottom line for me is that we have reached the point where once again in this administration, the nuclear issue is driving the question of how we deal with Iran. And as long as that's the driver of our policy, it will be a threatening policy, which I believe will, if pursued the way they say it's going to pursue, lead to war. At least a military attack on them, which will result in a reaction that will look a lot like war if it isn't a war. I can't imagine how this president or any president of the United States on this day, given all the global issues we face, given the fact that there are two wars in the middle of this part of the world, probably a third on the way, that we would open a military attack on Iran, whatever the reasons. So going down the sanctions route on nuclear and testing their sincerity or seriousness on the basis of whether they stop enrichment is, for me, not the way to go. Now, I guess I've talked longer than I should, but I do feel that this conundrum we find ourselves in with regard to Iran, which now, as of last Friday, is back in the same mode that we found ourselves in most of the Bush administration, quite a concerning and at some level quite terrifying direction for the United States to go in. And I hope that I'm misunderstanding what the president said. I'm hoping that the Iranians will be persuaded in some way that now's the time to talk candidly with us. Bill Burns, who is going there representing the United States, is a very good diplomat and is admired by the Iranians, which is not true of all American officials. And I'm hopeful that he will be able to bring back some sign that there's a way to go to get to discuss with them the problems. But ultimately, there's no way we're going to get an agreement with them on what we want on the nuclear question until we've made a general agreement to begin a strategic relationship at the very top. So that's my effort. Mm-hmm.